It's been 1 year since California's deadliest wildfire destroyed the town of Paradise.
Driving around, residents talk about how sometimes they miss the turn to their own street or even recognizing their own driveway if it's just now a dirt lot. And that's pretty darn traumatic.
A new breakthrough in the investigation of vaping sicknesses. And Saturday marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall.
This anniversary, this occasion, has given people an opportunity to talk about the legacy of reunification.
It's Friday, November 8th. This is the PM edition of What's News from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli in New York. Federal health officials say they've found a clue in the investigation into a rash of vaping-related illnesses across the United States. In a teleconference with reporters on Friday, Ann Schuchat with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said vitamin E oil was detected in all 29 samples taken from vaping patients tested by the agency.
These new findings are significant because for the first time, we have detected a potential toxin of concern, vitamin E acetate, in biologic samples from patients with lung injuries associated with the use of e-cigarette or vaping products. These findings provide direct evidence of vitamin E acetate at the primary site of injury within the lung.
Schuchat says the results aren't enough to be labeled a cause and that more studies need to be conducted to determine whether vitamin E oil was behind the vaping injuries. The CDC says there are now more than 2,000 cases of vaping-related illnesses in almost every state. 39 people have died. President Trump says the U.S. has not agreed yet to roll back tariffs on China as part of an interim trade deal between the two countries. Trump's comments today disputed China's assertion on Thursday that the two had agreed to remove mutual tariffs. But Trump did say there's been progress in negotiations to resolve the trade dispute. The U.S. and China have been searching for a venue to sign phase one of their agreement. House officials released additional testimony on Friday from witnesses who have appeared for depositions behind closed doors as part of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Documents have been coming out in a steady stream ahead of the start of public hearings next week. A transcript was released of Alexander Vindman's testimony. He's a White House Ukraine expert who listened in to the July 25th call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. Investigators also released the testimony of Fiona Hill, Trump's former top Russia advisor. Both Vindman and Hill testified that they were alarmed by efforts to push Ukraine to open investigations into the Bidens and the 2016 election, and that they raised their concerns to colleagues. A year ago, the Camp Fire ripped through Northern California, burning 153,000 acres and killing 85 people. It was the deadliest fire in the state's history, and it destroyed 95% of the town of Paradise. A year on, Paradise is still struggling to recover. Wall Street Journal reporter Aaron Aylworth covered the aftermath of the fire last year and joins me now. Aaron, tell us about the devastation in Paradise and how the town is coping 1 year later.
Well, the campfire burned 153,000 acres, and as you mentioned, most of Paradise, 95%. And what that means for the town is that for a lot of people who grew up there, who have long lived there, it's unrecognizable. The landmarks are just gone. They've been wiped away. And so driving around, residents talk about how sometimes they miss the turn to their own street or even recognizing their own driveway if it's just now a dirt lot. And that's pretty darn traumatic. I mean, you know, people lost their homes. They lost all of their belongings, family mementos. Some people, of course, lost loved ones. And so as the anniversary has come upon them, you know, they're still struggling with a lot of that grief.
And many residents have yet to return home.
That's right. There are only about 3,000 local officials estimate, and that's, you know, way down from the population in Paradise before the fire. It was about 26,000 then. Now, there was a bright spot in August when school started and more students came back to the school district than expected, although still not as many as there were before the fire.
Erin, we've talked before on this podcast about what's becoming a new normal for California residents, not only the increasing threat of wildfires, but also of scheduled blackouts to prevent them from occurring. What have you been hearing from residents about this new reality over the past year?
Some are grateful when the power is shut off because they don't want other communities to experience a deadly, destructive wildfire the way Paradise did or the way that certain neighborhoods in Santa Rosa did in 2017. But blackout after blackout, and Paradise has already been through a few of them, it's just frustrating. You know, you are literally in the dark and your food may go bad. You may not be able to go to work. Your kids may not be able to go to school. So it's another loss, if you will, on top of losses that they've already suffered. And so, you know, short power shutoffs, they're like, okay, maybe this is what we have to deal with. We don't want to deal with them forever. But, you know, days long, it really starts to wear on people.
Erin, California has some pretty big challenges in this area. What can you tell us about how the state is confronting the continued threat of wildfires?
You know, I think they're still largely trying to get a handle on that, but there have been steps taken. So CAL FIRE, for instance, has more dedicated brush clearing teams than it had in the past. They've also brought on help from the National Guard. And then local agencies and CAL FIRE, to some extent, are also trying out advanced technologies. And we wrote a little bit about that recently, but these are things like a supercomputer that can model where a fire might go once it starts using real-time weather data and, you know, past fires and known fire corridors. And then they've also got this plane that is outfitted with these infrared sensors and can go out and more quickly map the perimeter of a fire. And so that all of that helps these agencies figure out where to deploy resources to better effect.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Erin Aylworth, who will be back on the road to California. She's joining us on her way there, where she'll continue her reporting on the state's response to wildfires. Erin, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Another anniversary is coming up this weekend, but this one is celebratory. Germany is marking 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. That led to the downfall of communist rule in Eastern Europe and the reunification of East and West Germany. Our Sam Westren spoke about it with reporter Sarah Germano, who is in Berlin.
So, Sarah, could you tell me how the city of Berlin has been preparing for the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall?
So this week, the city of Berlin has had a number of exhibitions and installations that will culminate in a sort of celebration at the Brandenburg Gate on Saturday, the actual 30th anniversary of the fall of the wall. And there have been other sorts of commemorations throughout the city. As I mentioned, there will be a concert with lots of music from the 89-90 era and a large demonstration of ribbons sort of flying and floating over that road leading up to the Brandenburg Gate.
How receptive have people been to these celebrations and how important are they in the day-to-day lives of people living in Berlin?
One of the historians I spoke to said that there has been a huge difference in the emotional climate in Germany just in the last 5 years. Everyone says that the 25th anniversary in 2014 was this huge celebration and people were really happy about it. This year, things are a little bit different. This anniversary, this occasion, has given people an opportunity to talk about the legacy of reunification. Folks on the East have some agitation and a lot of nuanced feelings, but some uncomfortable feelings about the fact that a country they had lived in basically just disappeared. And for better or for worse, they say it wasn't necessarily a reunification of Germany, but that West Germany overtook East Germany. And there's also mixed feelings on the Western side, too, because for the many years after the country was reunified. The tax system was set up in such a way that the West German states contributed extra funds to encourage the redevelopment of East Germany. So all of which is to say there's definitely more awareness that there are fractures within German society and people are talking about them.
I mean, that's interesting because that reflective attitude is not something you tend to associate with the fall of the Berlin Wall, with all the images of celebration. You've chosen to use the wall itself as a way to kind of tell these stories. Could you just talk about the reporting that you've done in the build-up to the 30-year anniversary and some of the things that you've discovered?
Yeah, definitely. And the wall has become, the physical wall itself has become a really interesting way to tell this story because even though the collapse of East Germany happened 30 years ago, steps to commemorate the physical wall and preserve it and catalog it didn't happen for a long time. And it sort of ties into what we were saying before about the current environment in Germany. The country is now in the later stages of reunification, really beginning to grapple with the legacy. And so we chose to do that through trying to track the wall.
And one of these stories saw you searching for a lost piece of wall, the broken heart of Berlin. Could you just tell us about that story and how you went about finding this lost piece of wall?
This is one of the, I think, one of my favorite stories I've done in my career as a journalist. As we started our reporting a few months ago in advance of this anniversary, we tried to find out how many pieces of the wall still existed around the world. And there aren't that many. There are, you referenced the two, it's a broken heart. There are these two pieces of the wall. Each piece has half of a red heart. It had been originally painted in 1984 by an artist in West Germany. At the time that the wall fell, it got a lot of attention. A home builder in New Jersey, of all people, managed to get a contract with the East German government and import them into the U.S. They were the first whole pieces of the Berlin Wall to be brought into the U.S. There was a lot of demand for these pieces, and the New Jersey man who I mentioned who imported them, his name is Joe Cimarelli, he brokered a deal with a financial advisor in North Carolina who really wanted one of those pieces and bought it to feature in a museum he was establishing. So Joe Cimarelli put it on a flatbed truck, sent it down to North Carolina, but the left piece, its fate had been a mystery basically ever since. And there had been a lot of red herrings and diverted tactics. We had gone through old newspaper clips, some of which said that it went for auction at Christie's, called Christie's. They said they'd never done any such sale. They didn't know what I was talking about. We also heard that there may have been attempts to steal it. So anyway, in trying to prove or disprove some of these rumors, I ended up speaking with people at the USS Intrepid Museum, which is where the two pieces of the heart were originally displayed. At first, they didn't know where it was. And then after a deep record search, they found that they had sent the left piece of the wall to the German-American pop artist Peter Max in 2006. That led me to talking to Peter Max's studio and his family, and they told us that they still have the piece of the wall, and the wall actually is still in the United States, and it's with Peter Max's family.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Germano speaking to Sam Westren. And that's what's news for this Friday afternoon. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.